Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody, and happy Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Now we will play some excerpts from our 8th annual Martin Luther King holiday celebration, which we held yesterday at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Thanks, first of all, to Faraz Shadeya, my co-host, producers Maxie Jackson and Brenda Williams, and the great Apollo team who all worked to make it an inspiring success, in addition to many other folks here at WNYC who work behind the scenes. So we will play some of the panel discussions and some of the other highlights, and let's start with one of those. This is Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, who is the Hindu chaplain at Columbia and NYU and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and author of the book Urban Monk, Exploring Karma, Consciousness, and the Divine. You may remember this Urban Monk was a guest here recently to talk about his work and his book. He read part of Martin Luther King's Drum Major Instinct sermon, originally given on February 4th, 1968, 2 months to the day before he was assassinated.
The Drum Major Instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that sex was a dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, this desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And then the final great tragedy of the distorted personality is the fact that when one fails to harness this instinct, he ends up trying to push others down in order to push himself up. And whenever you do that, you engage in some of the most vicious activities. You will spread evil, vicious, lying gossip on people because you are trying to pull them down in order to push yourself up. And the great issue of life is to harness the drum major instinct. But this is why we are drifting. And we are drifting there because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. And so Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great because everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and your verb agree to serve. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know Einstein's theory of relativity to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics and physics to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love. And you can be that servant. Thank you.
Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, author of the book Urban Monk, chaplain at NYU in Columbia, reading from Martin Luther King's sermon, The Drum Major Instinct, from our King Day celebration at the Apollo Theater yesterday. We will hear Gadadhara Pandit Dasa again later on as part of a panel on Gandhi, King, and the politics of love. Another of the panels that we had at the Apollo explored some spiritual and political themes, and it featured Reverend Donna Scopper, pastor of the Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village, Reverend Peter Heltzel from the New York Theological Seminary, Reverend Melinda Weeks from the organization Race Forward, and Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library. This begins with my question about a tweet that we got after an earlier segment. Somebody tweeted after the first panel, Brian Lehrer argues history sped up around 1963. Tons of social change. Begs question, is history speeding up again now? Do you think it did 50 years ago? And do you think it is again now? Look at the election of Bill de Blasio. Look at the elevation of Pope Francis. Look at some of the other things that are going on. Maybe it is.
There's certainly something to be said about how we define history. And so if history is not the everyday, the banal existence of people and the movement of their bodies and their ideas across time, but in fact these moments of rupture, these moments of transition, of transformation, moments of significant change, then absolutely in this moment of 1964, this is truly a historic moment. I think the jury's out as to whether we are seeing the end of a 40-year period of a rightward shift in this country where the very definitions of liberal or conservative, of right and left, of how to even define the parties themselves. We could be at the end of a moment on the cusp of a transformation and a rupture, but this is where the historian is at a disadvantage, right? Because hindsight is the key to that analysis. I will say that in this city, the election of Mayor de Blasio suggests to me that there is tremendous possibility. But I also would caution that from a historian standpoint, the jury is still on how we read 2008 and the significance of that moment of hope and change and transformation, which seems to really be the end of a Reagan revolution rather than the beginning of something else. I'm just not sure. So that's my response.
For the rest of you, let our audience get to know you a little bit. Peter Helsel, you're an evangelical, which we associate so much with the religious right these days, but your quest is about justice and equality. Can you talk about what you call your theology of improvisation and why it's part of evangelical Christianity?
Yes. I'm very influenced by jazz music growing up down in Mississippi with the blues and jazz, and even coming in today and hearing Love Supreme is really an anthem for me in terms of how do we love and stay engaged. And one of the things that I appreciate about King as an evangelical is his deep faith in God. And early on in 1956, his house was bombed, January 30th, 1956. And he had a decision to make. Would he retaliate with violence? He had a gun and there were 100 folks outside that were ready to roll. But he decided not to, and to take the path of Gandhi and nonviolence. And shortly after that, there was this evening where he got out of bed, he couldn't sleep, paced around the house, and he said, I was ready to give up. With my cup of coffee sitting untouched before me, I tried to think of a way to move out of the picture without appearing a coward. In this state of exhaustion, with my courage all but gone, I decided to take my problems to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still in my memory. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, stand up for righteousness, stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever. Almost at once, my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared. I was ready to face anything. And I do think this is a moment of possibility. And if you're out there and feeling hopeless, press in, because you are a leader that can change this world.
Dr. Weeks, you're a preacher, a scholar, a consultant, an activist. How do these disciplines come together for you? And pertinent to the spiritual bent of this panel, what does religion have to do with it?
Wow, great question. Not going to front, excited to be on the Apollo stage. This is big. Well, I mean, in some ways, people can say the same thing about Dr. King. He was a scholar. He was a preacher. He was a theoretician. He was an organizer. He was all of these things. I think part of what faith has to do with it, it certainly has to do with Dr. King, is someone like myself, many of you in the audience, may have gone to church this morning. That's right. May have found yourself in part of the Black church tradition. And so we were trying to understand how King was able to understand his justice impulse as a man of faith. It's because he was located in this continuum of the Black church has always been part of a dialectic. It's on the one hand, because the Black church was born out of oppression, it was a critique of the Christian religion that was used to reinforce slavery. So you don't have Black church that doesn't automatically have a political analysis, but that doesn't also bring in its culture and its music as part of that struggle. And so that's interdisciplinary and necessarily so. And so what happens is a King's moral compass is fused between the continuum of this idea that is very evangelical of an emphasis on the slavery of sin, right? We understand as Christians that to be enslaved to sin is what Jesus is the answer for. But on the other hand, there is the sin of slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's an individual piety, but then there's also a structural transformation that is part of the liberatory work of the Black church in particular, of which Dr. King positions himself, but also fuses it in a way that most churches right now and most leaders are not necessarily doing. We tend to focus more on the individual piety, save my soul, but Dr. King said any religion that professes to be concerned with the souls of men and is not concerned with the slums that damn them, the economic conditions that strangle them, this is systemic, and the social conditions that cripple them, is a dry-as-dust religion. So you... Right. So you don't have a choice to be one thing. You have to be many things to deal with systemic oppression.
Donna Scopper, I'll bet you relate to a lot of that. Maybe you could tell the audience a little bit about the storied history of the Judson Church downtown, how it relates to Dr. King, and how you segue from Reverend Dr. Weeks into this moment.
Oh, what we have, Judson's been downtown for a long time, since 1895, and every new wind that has blown through the city has come through Judson as well. And right now we are, we said of my predecessor, the Reverend Howard Moody, who died last year, who was at Judson for 35 years, doing a magnificent job there. We said of him that he was at the head of the parade before most people even knew there was a parade. And I would say that that's been true of Judson and his leadership, but also was true of Dr. King, that what has made him so great and important to us is that he was out there, and he was ahead of us, and he was using a moral language that transcended politics, a spiritual language that made a sustainable energy for us, that brought us to our senses while so much evil was going down. And what Dr. King did was to give us the kind of leadership that Moral Mondays is giving us right now, the fracking movement's giving us right now, anti-fracking movement, that the new mayor is giving us. And it is indeed, I think, time for something really new, and history is speeding up. It's not just the end of the Reagan era in its smallness and coldness and inability to understand that people were suffering and that they were kind of stealing all the money. And it's time to get it back. Occupy Faith began that, but the mayor's going to complete it.
Peter Hetzel, you're smiling so broadly, you have to get the next word.
Well, I think that we are in a new moment. After two decades of Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg and a corporate lockdown on this city, the election of Bill de Blasio is a moment for us to engage as prophetic leaders in the tradition of King, because King was a revolutionary prophet. And sin wasn't just personal, it was social. And so King fought for fought against racial discrimination, and we saw the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, but then he turned his eyes to stopping the Vietnam War and to working for economic democracy. He always got out into the front of the revolution and where the spirit of justice is moving. So now people are looking to New York City, and they want to know, what is the Big Apple going to do? And now is our time. That's why the Apollo is packed today, is because people care and want to fight for love, justice, and peace.
That's true. You all could be home watching football right now. Instead, you're here. Dr. Mohammed.
All right, so since I have the unenviable task of making a claim that now becomes the basis for disagreement, or at least for stirring it up, let me qualify that claim. So to be fair to Dr. King, he was a man who wrestled with the pace of change. He wrestled with the moments of success, the boycott. I mean, he only lives for 14 years in the context of the movement. And he experienced tremendous setbacks, tremendous doubts, tremendous ambivalence. So I think his warning to us, both in the life that he actually led and the disappointments that he faced in the midst of the possibilities and a fierce optimism and a commitment that God would see us through this, is we cannot put the cart before the horse. We have to use history as a guide and a measure to where we actually are, because we can get riled up. We can be emotional. We can take an election as a marker that the change has come, but we would not, in fact, be learning from the legacy that King left us. I mean, here is a man who was assassinated at the highest point of his potential influence and had become persona non grata to the civil rights community that he helped to make. So was 1968, was history moving forward? It's hard to say in that moment, because it depends on the benchmark that we use to measure it. And so that is my caution, that we have work to do. I'll leave with one final note, too. King wrestled deeply with ideas. And the problem for me in a conversation about where we are in this moment is there are ascendant ideas circulating amongst us that have so fundamentally changed what we think is possible with regard to justice. If you ask people in many working class communities, and not the converted that is here today, what do we do in the face of games like Knockout? What do we do in the face of high rates of violence in the community? Many people will call for, we need more police officers. In spite of everything we've learned about policing and its fundamental flaws. So unless you have a new ethic of compassion, unless you put justice in the Christian sense over punitiveness and punishment in a secular sense, then we are only going to see cursory moments rather than fundamental change.
That just makes me also think about the necessity for a kind of holistic understanding of what makes systems shift and change. And that's the beauty of the vision that Dr. King was able to put before us. One of the things that makes me hopeful about the potential for change is to see the Kingian legacy being lived out in terms of emerging leadership in New York City. So, for example, we're at the Apollo Theater. We appreciate the fact of what came through this place in terms of the power of cultural change together with political change. And I think we're at a moment now where you see emerging leaders in New York City, like Tyrone Burkett, who's here, who has positioned himself in the prophetic tradition with his genre of music called postmodern spirituals, basically fusing in the freedom songs of the church, understanding how they were appropriated from the black church for the public square, for the sake of the movement. He's doing that in that same kind of tradition, fusing jazz and funk and blues and gospel for a liberatory message today that is also faith-infused. And so there's a way in which I see that kind of leadership in the city rising up, being critical and forwarding culture, some of the things that Nelson George was saying, as also necessary to change hearts and minds and these encoded beliefs that we have about inferiority based on race. So it has to come from leadership of all disciplines to still be understanding themselves and ourselves as squarely in the justice tradition as well.
Our time for this panel has fled, except for a final word from Donna Scopper. I'll let you reflect on anything that's been going on.
Well, I think what you're saying, I would call the practical plus spiritual power, moral language, cultural power, music. And I am hopeful that we're living a little bit beyond the practical, and we're ready to put some things together again. And that's what I like about the fusion of tactics. We're moving beyond community organizing that's just political into community organizing that is culturally, spiritually, personally, politically transformative. So, for example, what if we were to say that the $700 million that the city of New York gives to banks just to hold its money really didn't belong to banks, but belongs to taxpayers, and have a banking change that was very practical, very Alinsky, very we want the money back, and we were singing about it and toting the golden calf around the streets with it, and we were hoping for real that we were going to get that money back. That's the kind of power, moral power and spiritual power, that I sense is bubbling up right now.
Please thank this awesome panel of four. And that was one of the conversations at our Martin Luther King birthday celebration at the Apollo Theater yesterday. Reverend Donna Scopper, pastor of the Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village, Reverend Peter Heltzel from the New York Theological Seminary, Reverend Melinda Weeks from the organization Race Forward, and Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library. Now let's hear a little of Dr. King in his own voice. This is from a news report on Pacifica Radio covering Dr. King speaking outside of the Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center in California in support of singer Joan Baez and others who were jailed after an anti-Vietnam War protest. The year was 1967.
Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but he's a molder of consensus. And on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And that is where I stand today, and that is where I hope you will continue to stand so that we can speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters all over the world and righteousness like a mighty stream. And we will speed up the day when men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations will not rise up against nations, neither will they study war anymore. And I close by saying, as we sing it in the old Negro spiritual, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Martin Luther King, 1967. More excerpts in a minute from our Martin Luther King Jr. holiday celebration at the Apollo Theater. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, and we're listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Jr. holiday celebration yesterday at the Apollo Theater. Up next, we'll hear part of a panel conducted by my co-host for the event, Farai Shadeya, on the theme of the day, Dreams for NYC, inspired by MLK. Farai talked to Brooklyn Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, NYU education professor Pedro Noguera, Brett Wright, CEO of the company, the New America Agency, and Nelson George, writer, culture critic, filmmaker. The first voice is my co-host, Farai Shadea.
How does education, which is really your bailiwick, you know, relate to questions of a Manhattan and an America, which is becoming more affluent for some and harder for others? How does education, both in terms of the education children receive and in terms of the prospects of people going through the New York City education system, relate to these overall patterns?
Well, we've heard the mayor say that inequality was the issue that he wanted to focus on. And I would say nowhere is that issue manifest more clearly and starkly than in education. Because today we not only have schools that are still segregated by race, but also by class. And what we've done is we have concentrated the neediest and most vulnerable children in the most under-resourced schools. Under the previous administration, the only strategy they had for those schools was to shut them down when they failed. Mm-hmm. And what this mayor and chancellor will have to do is to demonstrate that they have another strategy to strengthen those schools by providing the resources they need that have to go beyond the classroom. We've heard a lot of talk about preschool, which is, I think, a good thing. But we need to think about healthcare. We need to think about social workers. We need to think about economic development, because when you look at the neighborhoods where school failure is greatest, what you find is concentrated poverty. What you find is a lack of resources and a lack of services. Schools can't solve those problems by themselves. And what we've got to recognize in light of Dr. King's legacy and in light of so many people saying that education is the civil rights issue of the 21st century, if that's going to be real, then we're going to have to create schools that can, in fact, begin to provide that avenue into opportunity, into the middle class. And that's going to take a bigger strategy than we've seen. I'm actually excited about what New York could do, because we've seen across the country the kind of reforms that were implemented under Mayor Bloomberg implemented elsewhere. Now we have a chance to take a different direction. And my hope is, I've already heard Carmen Farina say she wants a new paradigm, but hasn't yet articulated what that would look like. But she has said that she wants to bring hope back to the schools. And I think that we've used fear as a strategy. I'm inspired by the possibility of using hope as a strategy for change.
Thank you. Brett, I'm going to go to you next. Tell us a little bit about what you see in the business environment. You know, so much of jobs, careers, entrepreneurship relates deeply to how we have a shared future or not. And tell us, you know, in that context about the work you do.
Yeah, thank you. I think the challenge has been our ability to continue to develop infrastructures in our communities, businesses. You know, the days of the mom and pops are gone, you know, replaced with, you know, big box stores, the community grocers, the middle class family structure that allowed folks to make it and breed my generation who came behind them and benefited from hard work and infrastructure. And I think every community needs a solid business foundation and business base. And I think that part is lacking. Part of it is funding. Part of it is true entrepreneurship and opportunity, education. I think all of these things sort of impact us in a way that we don't know. And, you know, even healthcare is an issue. You know, it's become, you know, political football going back and forth. But when we think about the health and wellness issues that our community are suffering from, it's hard to get a good education when, you know, you're obese or when you're ill or when you have diabetes. I mean, when you look at the issues that we're having, both socio and economic, I think a lot of it has to do with that infrastructure of family structure that we were able to survive on. And it's the new renaissance has sort of left that opportunity out.
I mean, let me just follow up with you very briefly. I mean, I was raised by a family in Maryland where a lot of my ancestors were family farmers or, you know, carpenters, things like that. And when you say that the mom and pop era is over, I tend to agree with you. But what options do people have as work is just scarce overall?
Well, I think work was always scarce. I think the ambition and ideation and innovation and survival instinct to, you know, pick yourself up and do it, I think has hurt us because they don't have the education structure to really base it on anything. So we're out flying blindly. And I do believe that has a lot to do with the education piece. You know, I think our last generation was able to do it because our parents said, hey, we want better than you, you know, better than what we have. We've really worked hard to give you the best education we can afford, send you to the best schools that we could potentially afford. And now it's up to you to really take that and run with it. And I think there's a lack of ambition, too, on that scale for entrepreneurship and risk.
And Nelson, you are a Renaissance man in the arts and culture and writing. If you were 21 years old and moving to New York, do you think you would find it, if from some other place, do you think you would find it a hospitable place for, you know, a young artist?
Oh, no. affordability, I mean, the most important thing affecting the arts over the next 10 years in New York will be affordability and real estate. There's two groups that are directly affected by that. The young artists coming to New York, look at Harlem, Fort Greene, where I live, Lower East Side. These are places where we can directly look at the culture of New York City over the last 20 years and see the culture was affected profoundly in a global way, the coming out of these communities. Young artists don't live there anymore. They can't afford that. They're trying to make it in Bushwick. They're trying to find these areas that were fringe areas. So finding a place to live, to work, and to actually mess up in. Because part of being an artist is we had the opportunity in the 80s to mess up and still have a place to live. It's very difficult to do that now. The other group that's directly connected, and it connects to all of the conversation here, is the working class. Spike Lee, Russell Simmons, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Vernon Reid. These, what do they have in common? Working class families. Their fathers or mothers work for the city in many cases. Chris Rock's father delivered newspapers to the Daily News. They all owned homes. And these are Queens of Brooklyn. They were homeowners, their families. These kids were raised in the city. They went to city schools. And they created what I call New York City art. You may not like everything they did, but they were products of a particular environment, and their art expressed that, and it went global. It's increasingly hard for the same kinds of people to have homes in New York City. So we're looking at how the culture of the city will evolve without the working class families that inspire their children to be achievers, to take them to the museums, to take them to all of the things that make New York great, you begin to lose a lot of what makes New York special. We do have artists, some, you know, young tech people, let's say, coming in from around the country who are filling in Brooklyn and filling in areas. To date, their culture seems not as New York-centric. They are making global culture. They're making internet culture. The elements of street culture that then become pop culture, and that's from Jean-Michel painting to Russell Simmons' entrepreneurship, to Chris Rock's comedy, we can go on and on. I'm a little concerned that not only will the young artists find it harder to come here to work and live, but that the people who were not going to be able to grow and generate the kind of inherently personal New York artists that come out of this working class cauldron we call New York. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a concern. I hope the mayor and his wife, who seems to be very interested in the arts, I hope that's something they can really look at as a because it will affect, if New York is a brand, the brand is, you know, we have Wall Street. Art is a huge part of our brand. We do not have that versatility. If we're not leading and innovating, we're not the same city, and we're not the same attraction for business.
If I could just comment on one point that Nelson made, I mean, I think in terms of this housing issue, the last 12 years of the previous administration, trying to be kind, has unleashed a luxury condominium steamroller of gentrification that in many ways is like a cancer. It goes from one neighborhood to the next, devours that neighborhood, and then it goes to the adjoining neighborhood. I had an artist that came to me and said about the issue of artist housing and trying to create some affordability, so we're working together. But then he made an interesting point to me. He said, Hakeem, you know, I've now gentrified three neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Now, if I was in real estate, I said, well, can you let me know the fourth so I can invest? But I think his point was that traditional neighborhoods that were affordable for artists eventually, over time, no longer become affordable. And at a certain point, and we're already starting to see young people and artists and working families who came through the crack wars of the 1980s stood improve the neighborhood being pushed out. That's not right in New York City. And thankfully, we have a mayor who's articulated, I think, a bold housing plan, 200,000 units of affordable housing to address that issue. And I'm looking forward to working with him in that regard.
Fantastic. Well, we are almost out of time, but I wanted to just run down the rest of the line, starting with you, Pedro. Give me one thing, a brief thing, that of a vision you have for New York 50 years from now. Mm. You know, we may not be here, but what would you like to envision coming from the legacy of Reverend King, coming from our discussion about equality and opportunity?
Well, as a native New Yorker, I often say that, you know, our subway system is still the envy of the world, right? If you think about it, it is a fairly equitable system in terms of you can get around. It's relatively affordable. It's relatively safe, relatively clean.
That's pretty relative sometimes.
Our school system should be like our subway system. It should not be the case that because you live in a certain neighborhood, you can't attend schools there because you can't be assured that your child can get a quality education. And not only should they be quality, they should offer innovative education. We need to ensure that our kids are getting the skills of the 21st century that include the arts and that include preparation for the jobs of the future. So we need visionary schools.
Excellent. Brett?
Yeah, I'll be brief. I think the biggest struggle that I hope we can achieve is really a dialogue, and I think it takes leadership. I mean, we don't seem to have the same sort of community activism that starts small and mushroom clouds out. And I think it starts with good leadership, and I think the communities we really need to work on to develop a practice of bringing others with us.
Excellent. Nelson?
I'm hoping that we really look at the scale of the city differently than we have in the past 12 years. That the idea of putting high-rise buildings in residential neighborhoods is like, that's what they do in Houston. That's not what they do in New York City. So we have to protect the neighborhoods of the city. These are the incubators of the culture. Without the Brownsvilles and the Crown Heights and the Jackson Heights, these neighborhoods, we can't look at them as future targets for development. We have to, how do we nurture what is there? How do we support the indigenous institutions that, from libraries on through, to develop culture? And I think that's what I want to hope that we can see going forward.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much.
That from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Apollo Theater yesterday, part of a panel conducted by my co-host, Farai Shadeya, with Brooklyn Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, NYU education professor Pedro Noguera, Brett Wright, CEO of the company The New America Agency, and Nelson George, writer, culture critic, filmmaker. Many of our guests yesterday are authors, by the way, and you can see a complete list of their most recent books on our webpage at wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. More excerpts from our King Day celebration at the Apollo in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we listen together to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Jr. holiday celebration yesterday at the Apollo Theater. Our final panel yesterday was about religion, spirituality, and politics. We got into a fascinating riff on the politics of love during this that you'll hear, and Dr. King's interfaith influences, both influences on him and his influence on others. The panelists here are Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, the Hindu chaplain at Columbia and NYU, and author of the book Urban Monk; Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, senior religion editor of the Huffington Post and author of the book Teen Spirit, One World, Many Paths; and Dr. Janice Willis, whose book title describes her, Dreaming Me, Black, Baptist, Buddhist. Farai Shadeya and I co-host this panel. You'll hear my voice first. Pandit, someone asked me in an interview recently, who are your heroes? And I said, oh, you know, I'm boring. I have the same heroes as everybody else, Gandhi, King, Mandela. But what was Gandhi's real influence on King? Was it direct?
Oh, it was actually very direct. The thing that he really taught was that love and compassion are more powerful than violence. And of course, you know, his whole teaching of nonviolence or ahimsa are what basically provided freedom for India. And that was what really inspired Martin Luther King Jr. When Martin Luther King Jr. went to India, he said in a radio interview that now I'm more convinced than ever before that nonviolent campaigns are the most powerful weapons for an oppressed people. And he saw that the bitterness and hatred that are the aftermath of violent uprisings was pretty much absent in India. And he mentions that there seems to be an equality between the Indian people and the British people, and they're living in harmony because of this nonviolent approach. And I think it had a very, very direct influence on Martin Luther King.
King came from an explicitly Christian tradition. I don't think of Gandhi as coming from an explicitly Hindu religious expression in the same sense. Mm. Did he, or what was the role, you know, overtly or subtly, of things about Hinduism in Gandhi?
Well, there's a nice quote from Gandhi in which he says, "When doubts haunt me and disappointments stare me in the face, I turn to the Bhagavad Gita and find a verse to comfort me, and I begin to smile amidst overwhelming sorrow." So the Bhagavad Gita is, of course, one of the main spiritual texts of India. And we can see that Gandhi not only got inspiration and comfort, but he also got direction from the Bhagavad Gita. And, of course, in terms of the teaching of ahimsa, or nonviolence, in his autobiography, he mentions that a true practitioner of ahimsa will do his very best to protect even the tiniest creature and try not to harm it. And if one lives in that regard, they will grow in self-restraint and compassion. So I think that, to a good degree, he was influenced by Hindus. How could he not, in one sense? Right?
Fry.
Thank you. And Reverend Rauschenbusch, one of the things that I think is very clear about the civil rights movement is the role that faith played, you know, the walk of faith that people took, risking their lives and putting themselves on the line in many different ways. How does Christianity relate to that, and specifically in the sense that Christianity, like so many religions, has been used for liberation and for oppression? And what do you think Reverend King drew out of the traditions of Christianity around African American experiences, and not spoke just to Christians or just to black people, but taking the black Christian tradition and using that as leverage in this fight for justice?
Well, one of the most stunning things about King was his grandfather, of course, was also a pastor, as well as his great-grandfather. His grandfather was a pastor who started the NAACP in Atlanta. His father was also a leader. And so it was a type of Christianity that connected what was going on in the real lives of people with the faith, because they saw Jesus as living in a real time that faced oppression, and Jesus was speaking to a people who knew what it was that when he said, in quoting Isaiah, "I have come to liberate the oppressed and let the slaves go free," that meant something to them. And it meant something to King, and it meant something to King very powerfully because there were so many Christians who opposed him. And that's a really important message for us today, is that we think about, oh, isn't it nice that Christianity, that King was a Christian? But there were so many Christians, especially white, but also black Christians, who opposed King. They told him to be quiet, let's do this nice. And so it's really important to remember that he was from that tradition. But also, he wasn't just, he was deeply embedded in the black church, but he also transcended it. He also was very interested in Niebuhr, in my great-grandfather Rauschenbusch, in Howard Thurman, who is from the black tradition, in these other spiritual traditions that all formed in him this incredible prophetic but also deeply spiritual person who could speak in a language that met so many people where they were.
And what do you think that language, and I think your point about history and relating to the history of the life of Jesus in his contemporary times is really profound. But looking forward, we live in a society where we have many different faiths and also people of no faith, atheists and agnostics. How do the messages of Christianity get pushed through the words of King into a secular context? And do you think that we have the right framing around what Christianity meant to him and what it meant to those listening to him?
I think he always was working with other people, but importantly, he was actually being trained in this discipline of nonviolence that is a deeply spiritual discipline. It is not a religious tradition. It is a deeply spiritual tradition that requires training, and it is founded in love. The idea that actually, as Pandit said, love will you cannot triumph over your enemies using force. You can triumph over your enemies only when you use love, and they are transformed by your love. And love is not just a Christian idea. It is a powerful tool that is available to anyone. And so I think that, you know, the idea of, you know, this amazing idea of forgiving your enemies, the idea of loving your enemies, the idea of those who search for justice are the children of God, that doesn't require a belief statement. It requires that we do that work. And that is not restricted to any one religious tradition.
Thank you.
Could I follow up on that? Because, and we were talking about this backstage, but the presence of the word love in King's rhetoric, it would almost be anachronistic today. Even LBJ at the time used the word love and the language around love for some of his policy proclamations. I don't think if Bill de Blasio stepped up today at City Hall and said, you know, I'm going to institute universal pre-K out of love, people say, what? Are you from Mars? So can you talk about love as a political concept and how it ever was and what happened to that?
Well, I think love is a deeply spiritual act. We unfortunately, we've been a little bit hallmarked out of love. We have this idea that, you know, oh, well, I love you. But you know, love, when you read, and everybody should read King on love, because it really, you can't really deny what he's talking about, which is that it is I will love you into transforming you. I will not hate you because I will not let you do that to me. And so that's the kind of, it is a deeply spiritual discipline that, again, is for him comes out of a Christian faith tradition, but I think it is available to us all. And I tell you, if someone started using love in the same way that King did, people would listen. People would listen because it's inspiring. We want to transform one another, and we want to do it in a way that honors ourselves and one another. And it's a discipline. I keep on using that word because I think it's important to remember that King accomplished what he did because he had spiritual discipline.
Yeah, please. Dr. Willis.
Dr. King knew that practicing, putting into practice, loving one's enemies took courage and it took strength. And it was not easy. It's not easy to love. So this great collection of Dr. King's sermons that was put together shortly after the assassination by Mrs. King is called A Strength to Love. Mm-hmm. And King often talked in his sermons about the methodology, how one does it, not only why one should do it. And that was what I was looking for when I was young and 15 and marching with King in Birmingham. It was that we had possibilities to move the whole country forward if we could show, if we could put into practice this kind of love. Now, we had to learn about it. And the first thing we had to learn was what nonviolence meant. It was great. If you were in those church meetings, you know, we were teenagers, right? We were children. There were these older women, particularly in the community. It wasn't just King. There were a lot of women around King. Oh. And they would... We would test it, you know. I remember a young boy was called over by an older woman. I don't know, but it was September clock. But she pulled him over and she says, "Are you ready to march today?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm ready." And she says, "No, I don't think you're ready. You seem a little angry today." Now, you know, we're not going to have any of that. In other words, in order to get out there and march, we had to go through training. We had to be nonviolent, or else we stayed in the church that day. You stayed in the church and you did some homework or something, but you weren't ready to go out. Because Dr. King's movement was a movement of love. And that love said that you might not like this other person's ways. You might not like what they were doing. You're faced by somebody in a hood who's causing you harm. Even King said, you don't have to like them, but as a child of God, you got to love them. It was that kind of love.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Willis, your march with Reverend King took you into another faith than the one you grew up in, into Buddhism. And how does Dr. King's life intersect with Buddhism and Buddhist practice?
I see it, looking back, as a direct link. I don't see any... Theologically, there are differences between Christianity and Buddhism. I'm not claiming that they're not. But the ideas of love and of nonviolence and of action for others' benefit, that runs through Buddhism, it runs through Gandhi. And so what I really found when I needed it most was a methodology, a way to, you know, I didn't get it from going to church on Sunday, sorry. Sunday school didn't show me the way. I was always interested in how do we love our neighbors? How do we do it? I knew it was hard. I knew it required discipline. And with Buddhist methods of meditation on love and compassion, I find that there's ways to develop. But I go back home to Birmingham. I used to go to church with my father. No difference at all.
Yeah. I want to take a minute. I want to take a minute to express to everybody the regrets of Rabbi Joy Levitt, Executive Director of the Upper West Side Jewish Community Center, who was supposed to be here today and supposed to be on this panel, but she was delayed in Israel from where she was supposed to fly home yesterday. So let me channel Joy Levitt for a minute. And so maybe Rabbi Levitt might have said something like how the Jewish Black Civil Rights Coalition of that era was not just a political coalition of ethnic groups, but a spiritual coalition of religious groups. She might have talked about how Dr. King quoted the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, so frequently in his speeches, in addition to citing Jesus and the New Testament, especially the book of Exodus. Freedom from bondage, let my people go, 40 years in the wilderness, I may not get to the promised land with you. Moses and Martin Luther King will be forever linked through that. And then MLK inspired probably every progressive Jewish leader since, and some who are not so progressive. But his universalist view of God that I think we've been hearing about on this panel. So those are some of my words, not hers, but in the absence of Dr. Joy, that'll have to do for now, from that side of the spiritual divide. Paul Rauschenbusch, could I just get your quick thoughts on some stats that I pulled up? And these are not as organized as Farai's stats and made into a slide, but who attends religious services on a weekly basis? Conservatives, 55% of them attend on a weekly basis. Liberals, only 27%. Republicans, 55%. Democrats, only 39%. However, blacks, 55%, same as conservatives. Whites, however, just 41%. How does that all fit together?
Well, the important thing with a movement like King's and the movement he comes out of, which is predominantly a social gospel movement, it meant that the gospel has something to say about the important social ills of our day, and we have to address them. There are many, many groups that came out of that are working for those from a secular standpoint. So not everybody has to go to church to do good. I'm a reverend, so I'm like, come on to church. That all works for me. But it's not. You don't have to go to church to do the work of King. You can do the work of King wherever you happen to be. If you're a secular humanist, if you're an atheist, it doesn't matter. What you do is you continue a vision of respect and inclusion for all in humanity. And so, you know, the real thing here that goes back to that point, not all religious people and not all Christians and not all black Christians are living out King's dream. And so what matters more is that you understand that idea that we were talking about, this love, this experience. You listen to people like Jan who understand what he was about, and you learn from it, and you go forward with those spiritual messages, and they don't have to be Christian. They can be from anywhere.
Pandit, can I get you on this? And you two, and we're out of time?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to chime in on this concept of love and how Martin Luther King was inspired by how Gandhi demonstrated practically on an everyday level how he lived compassion and love. When he was in India, Martin Luther King, he learned that Gandhi would personally escort those who were labeled as untouchables. He would take them by the hand and escort them into the temples. And, you know, Martin Luther King said that in India they call it caste, and here we call it race. Basically, it's the same thing. And so I think that's really powerful that, you know, he didn't discriminate. And again, from my perspective, I think he was seeing it from, he was getting that inspiration from his own spiritual tradition, which suggests that we should see all beings, human or animal, with an equal vision.
And Jan Willis, forgive me for blanking on your name for a moment there.
Yeah.
But you get the last word.
Yeah, briefly.
Briefly. I'd like to say that, of course, King was greatly influenced by Gandhi, but he had also read Buddhism, and there was a close connection made that had consequences for Dr. King. In 1965, he made a statement about that was anti-war statement. Against the war in Vietnam. And lots of people within the movement turned on King. Now, the only other time they had turned on him from within was when he decided to put children in the forefront in Birmingham. He came under a lot of pressure for that. But then King got a letter the year after he received the Nobel Peace Prize for Peace. He got a letter from a Buddhist monk who had become leader of the new peace movement to end the war in Vietnam, and that man was Thich Nhat Hanh. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a letter to Dr. King, and he says, and he was explaining the immolations that, you know, the monks and nuns setting themselves on fire to call attention to the plight of the Vietnamese people. So Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a letter to Dr. King, and he said, you know, you of all people who understand struggling on behalf of others should take a stand on this issue. And Martin Luther King did. He came out with the statement. People said, no, 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 Martin, that's diluting the movement. What are you talking about people across the seas for? That will dilute our movement here. And Dr. King said in response, part of the statement that I read earlier, people who don't know why I should be concerned with the plight of the Vietnamese, just as concerned with them as I am concerned with African Americans in this country, those people don't know me. And so they each nominated the other for the Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh. When people say to me, oh, you call yourself a Baptist Buddhist, I can't quite see that. I show them two Buddhists together, Dr. King and Thich Nhat Hanh. Last word, briefly. This photo, it's sort of a rare photo, was taken at the press conference just before Dr. King went into Riverside Church in 1967 with his speech called Beyond Vietnam. So I remember when Christians were left, they were on the left. There was no problem with that. The folk I knew, they were out there engaged in social activism. They knew that you could love, and because of that love, you could work for the benefit of others.
Many of us still are.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you all so much. Fantastic perspectives.
And that from our Martin Luther King Jr. holiday celebration yesterday at the Apollo Theater. Our final panel, Gadadhara Pandidasa, Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, and Dr. Janice Willis, and my co-host, Farai Shadeya. We've been listening to various excerpts from our King Day celebration at the Apollo yesterday, which was called Dreams for NYC, inspired by MLK. My thanks again to Brenda Williams and Maxie Jackson, who led the WNYC team that put it all together, and all the great folks we got to work with at the Apollo. And of course, thanks to so many of you for filling the hall beyond our expectations yesterday. And we will end here, as we did yesterday at the Apollo, with some music from Harlem's own Gospel for Teens, under the direction of MAMA Foundation for the Arts Executive Director Vi Higginson. And one way to think of this as we go out is just a little appetizer for what's coming next on WNYC, Leonard Lopate's annual special of gospel music from the civil rights era. Stay tuned for that. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy birthday, Dr. King.
Gonna come.